Okay, we are in Ezekiel chapter 25, and we left off around verse 9 discussing, these are prophecies to the nations now, as you recall, and in chapter 25 we had prophecies to Ammon that we discussed last week, and then we were on the prophecy against Moab, and I was giving a little bit of information about Moab here at verse 9. Therefore, behold, I will open the side of Moab from the cities, from his cities which are on his frontiers, the glory of the country, Beth Jeshimoth, Baal Meon, and Kiriathaim. Now, these cities, I was just getting to the point here. He talks about opening the side, the idea of her flank being opened up to attack through the toppling of well-fortified cities. And he includes three of those that are named here. This first one, Beth Jeshimoth, means house of the desert. House of the desert is the name of the city. And Baal Meon is Baal of habitation. Baal of habitation. Of course, Baal is the title for one of their gods. And Kiriathaim, means two cities. Two cities. This I-M ending is a dual ending in Hebrew, and so it means two cities, probably a couple of cities together. Now, all three of these cities belonged to Reuben, and they were eventually taken by Moab. And in other words, they were originally in the territory of the tribe of Reuben, but they were eventually later taken by Moab, and so they're here designated cities in Moab. The latter two of these cities are mentioned in the Moabite stone, an archaeological find, so we have archaeological confirmation of their existence. Okay, we go to verse 10 then. Unto the men of the east with the Ammonites, and will give them in possession, that the Ammonites may not be remembered among the nations. Okay, NAS translates this, and I will give it for a possession along with the sons of Ammon to the sons of the east, that the sons of Ammon may not be remembered among the nations. So the idea here is that I will give it, namely Moab, give it for a possession along with the sons of Ammon, just like what had happened to Ammon that he just prophesied. Moab was going to share the same fate as Ammon did, to the sons of the east, that the sons of Ammon may not be remembered among the nations. Okay, Josephus says that Nebuchadnezzar came against Ammon and Moab 5 years after the destruction of Jerusalem. So after he came in and destroyed Jerusalem, he did go after Ammon and Moab and destroyed them, or came against them. That was in about 581 B.C., if it was 5 years after the destruction of Jerusalem, about 581 B.C. So they suffered under Nebuchadnezzar later. Then also both of these nations, Ammon and Moab, were overrun by the Nabataeans. The Nabataeans was another group of people. I'll talk a little bit about them. The Nabataeans overran them also, and they ceased to exist as nations after that, and they were kind of absorbed into the Arab nations. So the present identity of Ammon and Moab is just a part of the mixture that became the Arab nations. Now, the Nabataeans were the ancestors of the modern Arabs, and their origins are quite obscure. But they apparently were a Semitic tribe in the southeast of Palestine, and southeast down north near Edom. In fact, there's probably a lot of mingling between them and the Edomites. But they became a very strong kingdom in about the 2nd century B.C. So roughly in the period between the Old and New Testaments there, they became a strong people. And that's why you don't see much about them in the Bible, because they're in that period where the Bible is pretty much silent historically. So Nebuchadnezzar was to come against them, and then the Nabataeans later on kind of absorbed them, and they ceased to be nations. Okay, verse 11. And I will execute judgments upon Moab, and they shall know that I am the Lord. I will execute judgments upon Moab. Now, as with Moab, though, as with Ammon, there are prophecies of the reestablishment of Moab in the millennium. Jeremiah 48:47 is one of those. Speaking of the millennium now, and other nations coming to the Lord in the millennium and the restoration of things, that these nations will be mentioned again. Now, it may be somewhat debatable whether they will exist as autonomous nations or whether the identity will be remembered or brought back in terms of showing again for the glory of God in the millennium these things. It says there in Jeremiah 48:47, "Yet will I bring again the captivity of Moab in the latter days, saith the Lord. Thus far is the judgment of Moab." So he says he'll bring again the captivity of Moab. Now, it may be that God will restore those nations in their names There is reference to Egypt serving the Lord and Assyria serving the Lord in that day. Or it may be rather that the peoples that were once those nations are going to be all serving the Lord. So in effect, since all nations have come to serve him, the peoples of all those nations will be serving him. It's hard to prove it one way or another. There'll be one government, of course, in that day. And there may be various districts and so forth, but the prophecies do indicate that those peoples, especially perhaps to comfort the hearts of peoples anywhere, that if they will believe God, they will be restored and they will be brought in. It's going to be interesting to see exactly how this works out, because many times these names of nations will be mentioned. Now, we'll talk about Edom next, and I think they're one that isn't mentioned as being restored. At least there's no scriptural mention of them being restored in the last days. So verse 12, we start with the prophecy of Edom, against Edom. Thus saith the Lord God, because that Edom hath dealt against the house of Judah by taking vengeance, and hath greatly offended, and revenged himself upon them. Now Edom was a nation to the south of Moab, to the south of Palestine. Of course, Edom is this region just in the southern region just below Palestine. Of course, Moab and Ammon were on the east side of the Jordan. So Edom is to the south of both Israel and Judah, and then also of Ammon and Moab. Now, they were long-standing enemies of Israel, all the way back to the ancestor Esau's hatred of Jacob. Remember, Esau was the one from whom the Edomites came. Esau's name was also called Edom, and Edom means red. It's for the color red, and he was called Edom because he came out all red and hairy as far as his birth. So, Edom is a nation that came from Esau's descendants. And because Esau had a hatred from Jacob from the very beginning, of course, the nation that came from him also had that. They were related more closely to Israel than Ammon or Moab was. In fact, just to recall your mind to the family tree that these different nations came from, we have Terah, who is the father of Abraham, and then he has three sons, Haran, Abraham, what did we say, Abram, short? Nahor, and from Haran came Lot, so that means Lot was Abraham's nephew, and from Lot, as they left Sodom and Gomorrah, his two daughters, the incestual relationship resulted in Moab and Ammon. Now from Abram, though, we have Isaac, and from Isaac we have Jacob and Esau. Now from this you can see clearly that the relationship between Jacob and Esau is a much closer one, being brothers, twin brothers, than the relationship between Moab and Ammon, although Moab and Ammon were related too. Now Jacob and Esau, of course, were twin brothers, and yet it's clear that Esau hated, and the Edomites hated Judah, hated Jacob even more than the more distant relatives. And they had a number of clashes with Israel throughout their history. For one thing, when Israel was wanting to come back through the land on the way to Canaan's land from Egypt, the Edomites refused to let them through. That was Numbers 20, verses 14 and following. So the very first encounter, at least after they become a nation in Egypt, was that the Edomites resisted them going through the land. Numbers 20, 14 and following. Some four centuries after that, David triumphed over the Edomites, and was in warfare with them and triumphed over them. That was 2 Samuel 8, verses 13 and 14. 2 Samuel 8, verses 13 and 14, David's victory over them. They were also dominated, the Edomites were dominated by King Amaziah of Judah, and that's 2 Kings 14:7. 2 Kings 14:7 says that he slew 10,000 of the Edomites, took the city of Selah, and carried away 10,000 captives. You can also put 2 Chronicles 25, verses 11 and 12 with that same thing. 2 Chronicles 25, verses 11 and 12. Now, the Edomites won back their independence at the time that Syria and Israel invaded Judah. They seized that opportunity. Syria and Israel to the north, Israel, the northern tribes, and Syria formed an alliance, and they came down to attack Judah under the reign of King Ahaz. In Isaiah, the time of Isaiah prophesying. That was in the 8th century B.C., 700s B.C. And during that time, Edom smote Judah. They took advantage of them when they were down, you see, and took captives. That's 2 Chronicles 28:17. So they got back their independence and took some captives from Judah. Then when Nebuchadnezzar took Jerusalem in 586 B.C., the Edomites sided with Babylon and rejoiced over Judah's fall. So they were happy that the Babylonians were beating up on Judah, and they sided with him and rejoiced. A few references there, Psalms 137, verses 7 to 9. Psalm 137, verses 7 to 9. And Lamentations 4, verses 21 and 22. Lamentations 4, verses 21 and 22, dealing with that same thing of Nebuchadnezzar's taking them and Edom rejoicing. Now, there's a possibility that they occupied Judean cities during the captivity. After Judah was taken captive into Babylon, we don't have any detailed scriptural information about this, but there's some indications in other literature that they did possess some of the cities of Judah during that captivity. And one of them is from one of the apocryphal books, First Esdras, E-S-D-R-A-S. It's one of the apocryphal books, and of course they're not very reliable. But in First Esdras 4 verse chapter 4 verse 50, it says that all the country which they hold should be free without tribute, and that the Edomites should give over the villages of the Jews which they then held, indicating that the Edomites. The only point to quote that is that it's indicating that the Edomites held some of the villages of the Jews, and that they were having to turn over at a later time. So there are some indications, at least from history, at least that they did take some cities, and it would be a natural thing with their attitude of heart and their hatred for Judah. When Judah was being oppressed and taken captive, they may very well have taken advantage of that. So it's very likely that they did. All right. Also in verse 12, it says, because Edom hath dealt against the house of Judah by taking vengeance, and hath greatly offended and revenged himself upon them. So God is upset with them for taking vengeance, taking advantage of them when they were down, hating them. Literally, it means revenging with revenge. Revenging with revenge, taking vengeance, or revenging with revenge. Hebrew oftentimes repeats a word, a verb, uses a normal verb form plus an infinitive form of the verb to give a real strong intensification to the idea of the verb. So that's the idea, revenging with revenge. I mean, really taking vengeance, not just mildly. And he says, and hath greatly offended, NAS translates that, and has incurred grievous guilt. And has incurred grievous guilt. So God was holding them responsible, and they have grievous guilt in the matter of their attitude toward Judah. And so, because of that, God's bringing judgment upon them. Verse 13. See, it looks like everybody gets judged here. Judah gets judged because they haven't been walking with God, and then all the ones that have been oppressing them are getting judged. Verse 13. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, I will also stretch out mine hand upon Edom, and will cut off man and beast from it, and will make it desolate from Teman, and they of Dedan shall fall by the sword. Okay, he mentions a number of places here. He's going to stretch out his hand upon Edom, again indicating a stretching out for judgment, and will cut off man and beast from it. So there's going to be judgment that's going to affect both man and animal. I will make it desolate from Teman. Teman is in the Hebrew means south or southward. South or southward. It may refer to a city, one of the towns in Edom, or just the south region. And they of Dedan shall fall by the sword. Dedan in the Hebrew, the name, it's the name of, now we don't know the exact location of these two cities or areas, but the name Dedan at least means, in Hebrew it can have several possibilities. It can mean their love, or their moving, or their proceeding. So it's either got the idea of motion or movement or of love, as far as the Hebrew meaning of the name, but the exact location of these two cities or areas is unknown. Now, Teman was remembered, or is mentioned in the scriptures again as being renowned for wisdom. Jeremiah 49:7 is the reference. Jeremiah 49:7, this doesn't tell us where it's located, but it makes reference to it. It says, concerning Edom, thus saith the Lord of hosts, is wisdom no more in Teman? Is counsel perished from the prudent? Is their wisdom vanquished? So apparently he's talking something about their wisdom and the city being famous for that, and now it's being cut off. And, of course, the next verse there in Jeremiah mentions Dedan also. So both these towns or areas are mentioned there. So these are either cities or regions within Edom that we're not familiar with the exact locations today. As far as this wisdom is concerned, 1 Corinthians 1:19 can be included there as well. 1 Corinthians 1:19 is a parallel to that Jeremiah passage, God talking about destroying the wisdom of the wise. And here's a good example of that. Okay, verse 14. And I will lay my vengeance upon Edom by the hand of my people Israel. And they shall do in Edom according to mine anger and according to my fury, and they shall know my vengeance, saith the Lord God. So by the hand of my people Israel. And we find that the that this definitely did take place at different times in history. And I mentioned, alluded to David overthrowing them earlier. But in later times, this would take place. The Edomites were also overrun by the Nabataeans, this other group of peoples that I've mentioned to you. They gave the Edomites trouble in the Intertestament period. And then they were subdued by Judas Maccabeus, who was one of the leaders of Israel during the Intertestament period. You've probably heard of the Maccabeans and the books of the Maccabees. Judas Maccabeus, and then was a leader of Jews at the time in their wars against nations round about. They were primarily struggling against Syria, the Greek kingdom of Syria at that time. But then John Hyrcanus, later, even after that, John Hyrcanus forced compulsory circumcision and conversion to Judaism upon the Edomites. That was in 126 B.C. Now, of course, spiritually speaking, that's not the way to get converts, but he forced compulsory circumcision and conversion to Judaism. And John Hyrcanus. It's H-Y-R. This, again, is a name that you don't run into unless you look at Intertestament history. And, of course, in the books of Josephus, you'll find a lot of information on this as well. But he was another leader. He kind of succeeded the Maccabees and oppressed Edom there. So God said, by the hand of Israel, I'm going to judge them. And of course, this did come to pass in the Intertestament period. Then the Edomites also, at a later time, began to merge a lot with the Jews. There was a lot of merging and mixing and intermarriage, and also with the Arabs. And so they kind of fade from existence as far as a separate identity. Remember, the Herods that were ruling Palestine at the time of Christ were mixed Idumean blood. Idumea was the same, the name at that time for Edom. So there was a lot of mixing there. Now, as far as I know, there's no promise of restoration in the Bible for Edom in the last days, at least as far as their identity as a nation. It may just be because of their constant hatred for their brother Jacob, I don't know. But at least there isn't a mention. And of course, it kind of hinges on the question as to how we interpret those mentions anyway, as I mentioned before. One quotation from the book of Maccabees about, I mentioned to you about John Hyrcanus overthrowing them. 1 Maccabees 5:3. The books of the Maccabees, 1 Maccabees 5:3, I'll just read it. It just says, then Judas fought against the children of Esau in Idumea. This is, I guess, talking about Judas Maccabeus now. In Idumea at Arabatene, because they besieged Israel, and he gave them a great overthrow and abated their courage and took their spoils. So there had been, this, I guess, is referring to the time Judas Maccabeus did it earlier. Okay, but clearly there was fulfillment of those prophecies in a very direct, specific way, that Israel would bring judgment upon them, and it happened at least in a couple of instances. Okay, verse 15. Thus saith the Lord God, because the Philistines have dealt by revenge, and have taken vengeance with a despiteful heart to destroy it for the old hatred. Now we address the Philistines. The Philistines were a nearby and age-old enemy of Israel again. We're kind of looking at the ones all the way around Israel now, surrounding them. And among the enemies of Israel, the Philistines were referred to in the Old Testament more often than in any other nation. More times do you see the Philistines mentioned than any other hostile nation. They inhabited the coastal strip in southwest Palestine from Joppa to south of Gaza. So we're talking about this strip of land from Joppa here down to Gaza. And just a narrow strip of land about 50 miles long, about 15 miles wide or so, is the territory that the Philistines occupied. It wasn't really that big of a piece of land, but they sure gave a lot of trouble to the Israelites. And it was a very fruitful, well-watered plain. So, I mean, it was choice land for them to occupy. And like I said, about 50 miles long, about 15 miles wide. The Philistines apparently came from Kaphtor, as the name is mentioned, C-A-P-H-T-O-R. And this is just from the scriptures that are mentioned. Now, we're not sure exactly what the location of that is. Some feel that that was the Isle of Crete, and that that's where they're originally from. The references to that are Amos 9:7 and Jeremiah 47:4. I've got the Jeremiah reference close here. I think I'll take a look at that. Jeremiah 47:4. Okay. It says, because of the day that cometh to spoil all the Philistines and to cut off from Tyrus and Zidon every helper that remaineth, for the Lord will spoil the Philistines, the remnant of the country of Kaphtor. That's the spelling that I put on the board there. So they apparently came from the country of Kaphtor, wherever that was. Some feel it was the Isle of Crete. Also, Amos 9:7 refers to the same thing. Amos 9:7. Now, monuments show that they invaded Canaan with other sea peoples at the time of Ramses III of Egypt. So in the time of Ramses, from archaeology that we find in monuments, the Philistines invaded Canaan with some other sea peoples. And Ramses III, the chronology is around 1195 to 1164 B.C. for his reign, 1195 to 1164 B.C. The Philistines apparently were also repulsed from Egypt and Syria, and they migrated to southwest Canaan there, in that region that we find them. So they apparently were kicked out of other places and confined there. They gave their name to the country, Philistia, which later became Palestine in Greek. The name Palestine comes from the Philistines, and comes from Philistia. So the name that is commonly associated with the land in a general way came from them. And Palestine comes from the Greek transliteration, apparently, of the Philistine. Joel 3:4 is a reference to that, too. Joel 3:4, as far as Palestine is concerned. The Philistines are also pictured on reliefs on the temple of Ramses III, and they appear as tall Indo-European stock, possibly Grecian stock. In other words, they look more, from the carvings on the temple of Ramses, they appear to be more Japhethite rather than Semitic peoples, more of an Indo-European stock, more of the lighter skin, tall, that type of thing, possibly Grecian-type features. Okay, going back to the verse in question, verse 15, there's a statement here about the old hatred that they had. It says, I will destroy it for the old hatred. Now, it either refers to an ancient hatred or a perpetual hatred. In other words, it may be old because it's been going on for so long that, you know, it's an old hatred. In other words, it's one that's been with them for a long, long time. Or it's referring to an ancient hatred, a hatred that they had back at an ancient time. But it seems to be something that's ongoing. So that seems to be the tenor of this. And it's like the ancient enmity, the old hatred between Satan and the saints. Genesis 3:15 talks about that enmity between your seed and her seed, referring to the devil's seed and the seed of the woman. And Revelation 12:9 refers to the devil as that old serpent, or Rotherham says that ancient serpent. So there's an old hatred here, the old serpent, he's hated man from the very beginning, and he's been against man from the very beginning. Okay, a little bit of background on the Philistines as far as the back and forth thing between them and Israel. They constantly oppressed Israel until the time of David. Remember, during the period of the judges and everything, there was constant problem with the Philistines, and constant back and forth until the time of David, who fought and broke their power during Saul's reign. And 1 Samuel 13:7 and 14 gives the record of that. 1 Samuel 13:17, and then 14. I think it might be a reference to the whole chapter, 1 Samuel 14. Of course, David and Goliath, the story of David and Goliath and the defeat of the Philistines at that point. Then also they were conquered by Jehoshaphat, King Jehoshaphat, and that was in 2 Chronicles 17:11. Then again also by King Uzziah in 2 Chronicles 26:6. The Philistines were powerful during the reign of Jehoram, king of Judah. That's recorded in 2 Chronicles 21:16. So they apparently rose and came to strength during the weak reigns of some of the kings of Judah. 2 Chronicles 21:16. Also, they were powerful under King Ahaz of Judah. 2 Chronicles 28:18. 2 Chronicles 28:18. But they were subdued again by King Hezekiah of Judah. Hezekiah subdued them. 2 Kings 18:8. 2 Kings 18:8. And Isaiah 14:31, you can include Isaiah 14:31. And then there is a reference in the Psalms to them in a coalition of nations coming against Judah, Psalms 83:7, that the Philistines are joining a coalition. It says, Gebal and Ammon, Amalek and the Philistines with the inhabitants of Tyre. Asher is also joined with, and they have hope from the children of Lot. So it's listing all these different peoples, the Ishmaelites, Moab, and everybody is all gathered together against Judah and against God's people. And this may be looking more in terms of a long-term or end-time prophecy, all these Confederate ones that have come against them, maybe just looking at it figuratively of all the troubles that they've had all throughout history. But it could be, again, an allusion to the end-time Antichrist world government system, because many times these nations have been used in prophecies, not so directly in the ones we're looking at here, but in other ones in Scripture, as types of the Antichrist. And we'll see a real good example of that in chapters 26, 27, and especially chapter 28 of the King of Tyre, being a picture of Satan himself. So these prophecies often go way beyond the immediate nations and speak more of that final coalition of nations coming against God, all the haters of God's people, in other words, coming together in the end of time. One more point in verse 15. It says, "And with a despiteful heart to destroy it for the old hatred." This despiteful heart, the Hebrew is contempt in the soul, contempt in the soul. So their souls were full of contempt against the people of God. Okay, verse 16, "Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will stretch out mine hand upon the Philistines, and I will cut off the Carathims and destroy the remnant of the sea coast." The Carathims here, Cherathims, depending on how you want to pronounce this, were a part of the Philistines, a group within the Philistines, apparently. We have references to them, Zephaniah 2:5, and 1 Samuel 30:14 mentions these Carathims, apparently a part of the Philistines. And as to exactly their origin or how they fit in, some feel that their name is linked etymologically with the word for Cretans. And again, that may be the reason why there's a connection with the Isle of Crete or something, but some connect them with the Isle of Crete, Carathims. So it's not something clear-cut or proved, but there is some have suggested a connection there, and that they may have come from that area. Or, if you translate the word literally, Carathims, there's a Hebrew word, karas, that means to cut. And this may be coming from that root. And if it does, then it could be the cutters off. The cutters off would be the meaning. And if it is, then you can see he says, "I will cut off the cutters off." You see? In other words, the word for cut off there is the same word, and he's going to cut off the cutters off as a play on words. That commonly happens in prophecy. So that may be a good possibility also. Referring to the Philistines then as the ones who were cutting off Israel, God's going to cut them off. Okay, verse 17. "And I will execute great vengeance upon them with furious rebukes. And they shall know that I am the Lord when I shall lay my vengeance upon them." So I will execute great vengeance upon them with furious rebukes. Vengeance again. Philistines took vengeance on Judah, so God's now taking vengeance upon them. And Revelation 18:6 is a good principle to apply to this. Revelation 18:6 says, "Reward her even as she rewarded you in double," referring to Great Babylon and how that she had oppressed God's people. Now, after the Maccabean times, the Philistines disappear from the scene. Only the names of their cities remained, and so they as a nation again disappeared after the time of the Maccabees. Okay. Now we start in chapter 26, and just a quick comment on the chapters to come. Chapters 26, 27, 28, the next three chapters, are a prophecy against Tyre and Sidon. Tyre and Sidon, of course, are located on the coast again further up. Now, we just talked about the Philistines, and just you go a little bit further north, and you have Tyre and Sidon. So we've been making a complete circle around Israel. Tyre and Sidon are going to be prophesied against now in these next three chapters, and there's quite some quite remarkable prophecies here. And this forms the longest prophecy on Tyre in the entire Bible. We've got three whole chapters devoted to Tyre. And most of these other nations just, you know, had a few verses devoted to them. But we're going to see part of the reason for that is, number one, one of the most remarkably detailed prophecies in all of the Bible is contained here with regard to the destruction of Tyre. And it serves, in fact, Peter Stoner's book on, what's the title of it? Science Speaks. Yeah, Science Speaks. He goes through this prophecy and delineates this and shows what the mathematical probability would be of anybody guessing that this was fulfilled this way. It's quite remarkable. You'll see, and I'll make comment on it as we go through. So there's reason there, just because of the fact that there was such a detailed fulfillment of the prophecy that would serve for confirmation of the authenticity of the Scripture. And it certainly does that. Also, there is, in 28, this detailed description of the king of Tyre and the whole picture that gives us insight into the fall of Satan in the beginning. So there's a lots of complicated theology that's woven into these prophecies that's over and above just a prophecy against Tyre and Sidon. So that that alone would give justification for much more time devoted to them. Also, chapters 29 to 32 after that is a prophecy against Egypt, and that's also a very long drawn out one. Now, these nations are somewhat further from Judah than the previous nations that we've discussed. And in fact, the nations we've already talked about, Ammon, Moab, Edom, and the Philistines, those nations could all be seen with a naked eye from Jerusalem. If you were standing in Jerusalem on a clear day, you could look and see the area of the Philistines. You could see over to the east the areas of Ammon and Moab, and looking to the south, you could see Edom. So they were all within the sight of the naked eye. Tyre, though, was farther north, not a whole lot, though, about 35 miles as the crow flies from the Sea of Galilee to Tyre. That's like from Seattle to Tacoma, approximately. And that's from the Sea of Galilee. Now, from Jerusalem, it's about 100 miles as the crow flies from Jerusalem to Tyre. And that's like Seattle to Centralia or so. And it's about a few days' camel ride away, in other words. And Tyre was some 25 miles south of Sidon. Sidon is about 25 miles further to the north of Tyre. Most of it's focused on Tyre, though. Now, the background of the word Tyre means, the word Tyre means rock, probably coming related from the Hebrew tsur. The Hebrew is tsor. It's got a slightly different vowel point, but it's probably related to the Hebrew word tsur, which means rock. And so that's what the apparent meaning of the word is. And it may have to do with the rocky area there, and we'll see that even the prophecy got to scrape them like the top of a rock. So it's almost a prophetic name. They're first mentioned in the Bible in Joshua 19, verse 29. Joshua 19, verse 29. And they're referred to as a kind of a border point of the tribe of Asher when they're dividing up the land and designating the boundaries of the various tribes. And so they're just mentioned, the city of Tyre is mentioned there as a kind of a border point for the tribe of Asher. The founding date of Tyre is uncertain. Herodotus, the Greek historian who lived about 490 to 430 BC, he said that the city was founded in about 2740 BC. Josephus, though, says it was about 1217 BC. So you've got quite a range there, 2740 to 1217. They're both probably wrong. So I really can't give you an answer as to the founding of the date of Tyre. The Phoenicians, now Tyre and Sidon, this area is also called Phoenicia. So the term Phoenicians is often used for the peoples in these areas. The Phoenicians, like the Greeks, were not really a national unit, but rather organized in city-states, and that's why we focus on Tyre and Sidon. They're kind of city-states and a kind of general name for the peoples of the Phoenicians, just like it was in ancient Greece. Before Greece was unified, it consisted of a lot of city-states. And the dominance shifted between Tyre and Sidon. It kind of went back and forth between one or the other as to who was the most dominant. The history of the Phoenicians becomes more clear, though, in David's time, the time of King David. We find a man named Hiram, H-I-R-A-M. Hiram was king of Tyre in about 981 to 947 B.C., and he was a friend of King David. And that's 981 to 947 B.C. And he was a friend of King David. He sent messengers and cedar and carpenters and masons to build David's palace. And that was in 2 Samuel 5:11. Of course, they had the tall cedars of Lebanon up there. They had ideal, and they had skilled craftsmen that were used to working with these materials. And so they came and helped build David's palace, 2 Samuel 5:11. And Hiram did the same with King Solomon, who succeeded David, supplying him with cedar and cypress, and for the temple of God, of course. Scriptures on that, 1 Chronicles 14:1, and 1 Kings chapter 5, 1 Chronicles 22:4, and 2 Chronicles 2:3-18. All referring now, Solomon paid with wheat and oil, paid with the crops that they had, the wheat and the oil that they were blessed with. Now, there was another Hiram of Tyre, not the king now, not this one that we mentioned before, but a Hiram, who apparently Hiram was a popular name, I don't know. But Hiram of Tyre, who was a skilled bronze worker, and he made most of the molten objects in the temple. And so he's mentioned, and that's recorded in 1 Kings 7:13-45. Kings 7, 13 to 45, the big brazen pillars and so forth were cast by him. Solomon gave 20 cities in Galilee to Hiram, who later expressed dissatisfaction with them. This is probably to King Hiram now. And that's recorded in 1 Kings 9, 11 to 14. 1 Kings 9, 11 to 14. Hiram was apparently not pleased. The unhappy Hiram termed the district Kabul, which Josephus said was Phoenician, for that which does not please. So he even named the area that which does not please. And so he wasn't too thrilled with it. Solomon and Hiram were in a trade partnership also on the Gulf of Aqaba. See, Hiram supplied shipbuilding and able seamen in exchange for access across Israel to the Red Sea and the trade routes to Ophir. So being up here, they wanted land routes across Israel through this stuff to get down to the Gulf and out in the Red Sea and then be able to get out into the Indian Ocean and trade, you know, within India and places like that for the gold of Ophir and so forth. So they had kind of a trade agreement that way and help one another. And Hiram gave him shipbuilding and able seamen and things that they needed for so that he could have access across the land to get down to the Gulf and be able to get out. And, you know, see, otherwise he had access to the Mediterranean Sea, but there'd be no way to go around unless you had to go all the way around Africa to get over there. This way it'd be easy to get down to the Gulf of Aqaba, down in the Red Sea, and then out to the Indian Ocean. let's see, I don't know if I gave you scriptures on that. That was 1 Kings 9, 26 and 28. 26 to 28. 1 Kings 9, 26-28. Now, Tyre was a very busy and prosperous city by this time. The Tyrian ships sailed to Egypt, Cyprus, Rhodes, Sicily, North Africa, Spain. In other words, the Phoenicians were famous for their ships, and they were sailing all around the major areas of the Mediterranean Sea, down in Egypt, on the island of Rhodes, and Greece, and so forth, all these areas, Cyprus, and then on into Spain. So they were masters of the sea. They traded in cedar and wheat, oil and wine, and dyed cloths, and the famous crimson dye made from a shellfish that was found on the coast there. just have a comment from Wycliffe's commentary on that. It says, the Minoans and Greeks had utilized the mollusk in making purple dye before them, but the Phoenicians, especially of Tyre and Sidon, had a superior grade of shellfish with which to work. So much work was involved in dyeing a single piece of cloth because only a few drops of dye could be obtained from one mollusk, from the crushed shell, that only the wealthy could afford such material. So if you're going to have to just get a few drops out of each crushed shell, it's going to take a lot of shells to do a dye a garment, so it was for the very wealthy. Also, they were in a cargo business, carrying tin and tin ore from even up in England, and silver from Spain and copper from Cyprus, so they were transporting cargo metal ores and things as well. So this made Tyre one of the great commercial cities of the world, and hence their strength and power with their great commerce. Tyre was located on a small rocky island about a half mile off the coast, there is, in other words, you don't see it on a map here, but there's a small tiny island about a half mile off the coast that apparently the old city was founded on. There's some debate about this, but the older writers refer to Old Tyre as being located on the mainland and New Tyre located on the island. So apparently the view is that the original Tyre was on the mainland there on the coast, and then some of the peoples colonized the island out a half mile off the coast and added to the city there. Wycliffe's historical geography says that Hiram the First took over when Tyre was two small islands, and he joined them and made him into one larger island, and probably filled in the area with rubble and so forth, or with soil. Now, he says, whether or not there was a Tyre on the mainland at the time is uncertain. At least it is commonly agreed that the island Tyre was founded earlier than the town on the mainland. So now he says just about the opposite. So he says the island Tyre was founded earlier than the one on the mainland. So you've got kind of a contradiction there as far as the historians are concerned as to exactly which Tyre was found first. So if you see Old Tyre, it depends on what book, whether they mean the island or the mainland. Now, there would be an interesting development about that distinction between the island Tyre and the mainland Tyre a little later on when the fulfillment of these prophecies come to pass, because we'll see that the Nebuchadnezzar drives them from the mainland off into the island, and then Alexander the Great later on in history finishes them off there, as it were, as far as fulfilling the prophecy. Okay, so I can't tell you for sure. We've got comments both sides as far as which was the oldest. Apparently they're both very ancient, so it's hard to tell. Hiram built a big breakwater, which made Tyre one of the best harbors in the eastern Mediterranean. to build a big breakwater to protect the ships, and they had an ideal harbor there, of course, to help promote their trade. Yes?
Was the breakwater on the island or on the mainland?
I'm not sure there. I think it would probably bring them into the island, but I'm not positive. I'm not positive there. The source didn't say. I suspect that a lot of the shipping and things were done on the mainland, but I can't be positive of that. Okay, in the time of Ahab of Israel, King Ahab, of course you remember good old King Ahab, infamous King Ahab and Jezebel. At that time, Ethbaal was king of Sidon, city north of Tyre there, and possibly also of Tyre, as well as being the priest of Astarte, one of the female goddesses. And he married his daughter Jezebel to Ahab. Ethbaal is the one where Jezebel came from, and she married Ahab. That's 1 Kings 16:31. So Ahab marries the daughter of the priest of Astarte and the king of Tyre and Sidon. And then Ahab and Jezebel had a daughter, Athaliah, who married the king Joram of Judah. So kind of spread it down to Judah also. Now remember, Ahab was king of Israel, the northern tribes. And their daughter Athaliah married King Joram of Judah. So there was all this cross play between Sidon and Israel and Judah. The main deity at this time in Tyre was Melkart, M-E-L-K-A-R-T. Melkart, M-E-L-K-A-R-T. That was the main deity they were worshiping. And this was another aspect of Baal. Baal is kind of a general name for their gods, and this was a particular Baal, kind of. The polytheists have kind of general overall concepts of unity in their deity, and then within that unity there are many different personalities, you see. And if you see any parallel to the language of the doctrine of the Trinity, don't be surprised. Okay, let me read something about Melkart here. Melkart, or Melkarth, depending on the spelling, was the supreme deity or Baal of Tyre, and was styled Lord of the Sun, supreme ruler, giver of life, embodiment of the male principle, god of productivity. So they're associating with life and the male principle, supreme ruler, the Lord of the Sun. He was identified by the Greeks with Hercules. Of course, there was all these heathen gods are pretty much the same gods. They'd have different names in different cultures, you know, but Hercules was the embodiment of this god, apparently, among the Greeks. They had temples with an altar and a sacred pole, and it probably was a phallic symbol, and a stone and a statue of Baal in their temple. And, of course, they sacrificed animals. They had food and drink offerings and sometimes human sacrifices. Baal was said to die in the fall, and therefore he was mourned. So in the fall, when the winter was coming, that was the death of Baal, and they had to mourn for him. But then, fear not, he arises in the spring. And with spring, they had their god coming to life. This is a theme in almost all pagan religions. And there was exuberant festivals with sex rites also in the spring especially. The temples had chambers for sex with male and female temple prostitutes as well, and this is, of course, par for the course as far as heathen worship is concerned. Okay, so that's a little bit of background information about them. A few other things here as far as history is concerned. The Assyrians fought with Tyre at various times. Of course, the Assyrians up in this region to the east and to the north and east had run-ins with them at various times. I don't know if I'll mention these. I don't know if you need to put all this down, but just for historical information. In 1094 B.C., Tiglath-Pileser I raided the area of Tyre and Sidon. That was 1094. And in 876 B.C., Ashurbanipal, I guess that's the spelling here. And there's Ashurbanipal, too. I want to make sure I get these right. Yeah. Ashurnasirpal, received tribute from Tyre. I don't know if you think it's even worth putting a lot of these names down. In 853 B.C., Shalmaneser III of Assyria defeated the army of the allied states and cities at Karkar, including Tyre. And Tyre paid tribute, but they were still independent. And 727 to 722 B.C., Shalmaneser V besieged Tyre for 5 years unsuccessfully. It ended up with a treaty. And I'm always amazed at these ancient, at the persistence of these ancient armies, 5 years sieging the city, 5 years time trying to overtake somebody, and then you sign a treaty afterwards. It's amazing. It was 13 years. I'm getting a little bit ahead of the story, but the Babylonians took 13 years. 677, S.R. Haddon destroyed Sidon and laid tribute on Tyre. So they had trouble with the Assyrians, just like a lot of other peoples in the land. Now, the Neo-Babylonian Empire tried to take Tyre under Nebuchadnezzar, and he besieged it 13 years. So it's a disputed point whether Nebuchadnezzar actually took Tyre at this time. If not captured, at least it declined somewhat in power. And the siege lasted from 585 to 572 B.C., so it kind of comes just after the destruction of Jerusalem. And I've got a statement here from Wycliffe's Historical Geography about that. It seems that ultimately Nebuchadnezzar was successful in taking the mainland part of Tyre. But without a fleet, he could not take the island city, which surrendered on conditions favorable to the citizens of the island. So he couldn't really take the city, the island city. He apparently took the mainland, and the island city still remained intact, so they kind of signed a peace treaty. Mainland Tyre remained in ruins until the days of Alexander the Great. In this way, the first stage of Ezekiel's prophecies against Tyre was fulfilled. We'll get into the details of that later on as to why that's significant. Then during the Medo-Persian period, after Babylon, of course, came the Medo-Persians, and they became a ruling empire in the world. And during that period, there was a generally a peaceful relationship with the Phoenicians, except for a couple of revolts against the Persians in the 4th century B.C. So the main fulfillments here deal apparently with both the Assyrians and the Babylonians, and then a little bit later on with the Greeks. Now Alexander the Great, now we're talking quite a bit further down in history. Alexander the Great besieged the city of Tyre for 7 months in 333 B.C. And we're talking about the island city now, where they'd taken refuge. He succeeded in taking it because he built a causeway out to the island, about a half mile long and about 200 feet wide, just a causeway of land. In other words, what he did was they took the homes and the monuments and everything that had been torn down from the mainland, all the rubble, and they hauled it off and dumped it in the water and built this causeway out to the island city. And because of that, he was able to take the island city. Now, Old Tyre, according to the ancient writers, then would be the old city that he threw in. Of course, other writers say that it was the island that was the Old Tyre. But regardless, the mainland was scraped like a rock, as it were, and all this debris was cast into the water so that they could build this causeway out to the island. Approximately 30,000 Tyrians were sold as slaves, and 2,000 of their leaders were hanged as a result of this conquest by Alexander the Great. 30,000 sold as slaves and 2,000 hanged among their leaders. After this, Tyre was slowly rebuilt. The causeway apparently still remains, but it never rose to its former glory, never became a mighty city again, and it remained a trade center in the Grecian and Roman times, so there's still trade and activity going on there. It's still mentioned, of course, in the New Testament. Then later it was conquered by the Arabs in 636 AD, modern era. 636 AD, the Arabs conquered it. And today there's a minor town in Lebanon called Sur, S-U-R, with about 12,000 people, and that's all that really remains of this ancient power. And of course, the site of the old city, or the mainland city, was never rebuilt. That just remained as today. It's a place for the spreading of nets, like the prophecy said, and I've seen pictures of it. And the modern city of Tyre is located in a different area. In other words, it may take the same name, but it's not that ancient city. And God said it would never be rebuilt, and it was never rebuilt on the site. So that's something that we'll get to a little bit later on and make note of. One more comment about the Phoenicians before we go into the prophecy. It was once thought that the Phoenicians invented the alphabet. Sometimes you'll see references in historical books and so forth to that the Phoenicians invented the alphabet. It's doubtful that they originally invented the alphabet, but they did pass it on to the Greeks, who added vowels and in turn passed it on to many other people. So what we know is the Greek alphabet, and so forth came from a lot of the Phoenician letters. And some of you have seen books, in Greek grammar books and Hebrew grammar books. They'll show various alphabets of various peoples, and the Phoenician alphabet is almost always included there. That's possible. That's possible. I'm not sure if it's that or if it's just from the sound phonos, phonos meaning sound. That would probably be the most likely choice for me, that I would guess. But there may be a relation to this. I'd have to check the etymology on it. Okay. According to Lambden's book on Hebrew grammar, the book that we use in the Hebrew course here, the Northwest Semitic branch of the Semitic languages consists of Aramaic and Canaanite Ugaritic, Phoenician, and Hebrew. So the Phoenician language and the Hebrew language are all part of the same Semitic group of languages, and that's why there's similarities between these languages. A lot of them are so similar that if you learn one of them, you can adapt to the other languages pretty well. And of course, the Aramaic uses the same script that Hebrew. Hebrew had an older script earlier, but then adopted the Aramaic script later on. And the script that we use, we see the Masoretic text, is this later Aramaic script. Okay, we've got a few minutes here, still before the first hour. Let's start with chapter 26 then, with that background on Tyre and Sidon. And it came to pass in the 11th year, in the first day of the month, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying... Now here again we have some time element, but it's not really a complete time element, because it says in the 11th year, in the first day of the month, and it doesn't say what month. You know, it's the first day of the month, but it doesn't say which month it is. This is the 11th year of Jehoiakim's reign, and therefore of Ezekiel's captivity, taken captive with King Jehoiakim here. So the 11th year would translate in our chronology to about 586 B.C. 586 B.C. Now that's the year, of course, that Jerusalem was destroyed. And Jerusalem was captured in the fifth month, in the ninth day of the fifth month. That's when the capture of Jerusalem took place in this year. The fourth month and the ninth day. And then it was destroyed in the fifth month, in the tenth day. I'll give you scriptures on it in a moment. But Jerusalem was destroyed the fifth month in the tenth day. References for those two events, Jeremiah 39, 1 to 7. Jeremiah 39, 1 to 7. Jeremiah 52, verses 4 to 14. Jeremiah 52, verses 4 to 14. And 2 Kings 25, 2 to 4. 2 Kings 25, verses 2 to 4, and verses 8 and 9. 2 Kings 25, verses 2 to 4, and verses 8 and 9. Gives those time elements. Now, Ezekiel gave the year and the day of the prophecy, but not the month. And it's probably, because of the other scriptures that we find, he probably gave this in the fifth month. In other words, a month after the capture of Jerusalem. Because it does mention the Tyrians rejoicing over the capture of Jerusalem. So the capture of Jerusalem must be an event that had taken place. And since that was in the fourth month, in the ninth day, and whatever month this is, it was the first day of the month, it would have to be at least the fifth month. In other words, it's at least after the fifth month, the first day, that this prophecy is given. So probably the most, and since it's all very eminent and so forth, it's probably likely that this, even though the month isn't mentioned, it's the fifth month and the first day, most likely. If not the fifth, at least after that time. Okay, in verse 2, Son of man, because that Tyrus hath said against Jerusalem, Aha, she is broken, that was the gates of the people, she is turned unto me, I shall be replenished, now she is laid waste. Okay, he mentions that Jerusalem is the gates, she is broken, that is the gates of the people. Jerusalem controlled some of the trade routes that connected Arabia and Egypt with the north. So the trade routes that came from Arabia and down here and from Egypt would go through Jerusalem and the major trade routes. And so Jerusalem was in a strategic position to control things as far as those trade routes are concerned, and that's apparently what's being referred to. And so now she was the gates of the people. In other words, they had to go through there, and they had to have pretty good relations with Jerusalem in order to make it through. Jerusalem may have even levied tolls on caravans coming through and extorted money that way. So when Judah subjugated Edom, she controlled caravan routes to the Red Sea, and thus would hinder the Phoenicians from access to the Gulf of Aqaba and therefore to the Indian Ocean again and out. And so Edom, of course, was to the south, and because Judah dominated Edom for much of the time, they would also have control again from any access for these people overland down to the Gulf. Okay, so that was another strategic point. And that seems to be the reason for the rejoicing here, that they're rejoicing that Jerusalem is broken so that now they have access down, and it's commercially advantageous to them. Okay, we have to take a 5-minute break for them to change the tape, so we'll stop right here. Say a little bit more about this before we move on.